Very good morning to everyone. The first case on this morning's call is number 02-2634, Daniel Hoseman against Sidney Weinschneider. And Mr. Radke.
May it please the court. We're here today to ask you to reverse the district court's decision and to enter an order consistent with the judgment that the bankruptcy court entered. The debtor in this case, Mr. Weinschneider, received a discharge of his nursing home-related debt in excess of $10 million. In exchange for that extraordinary relief, he was required to report whatever interest he held in property so that it could be used to pay his creditors. And while he was in Chapter 11, he was a fiduciary. He had a fiduciary duty to his creditors to maximize the value of his estate and to refrain from self-dealing. This court has recognized that the integrity of the bankruptcy system depends on the debtor's complete and honest reporting.
Mr. Radke, could you explain what evidence at trial or elsewhere in the record led the bankruptcy court to conclude that Mr. Weinschneider fraudulently induced you,
trustee.
The trustee, to sign the release?
The release was signed several years into the bankruptcy case. At the time the release was signed, the trustee knew only what was in the record.
I understand that. What I'm looking for is
under the bankruptcy code, the debtor has an affirmative duty to accurately report its assets. And in a bankruptcy situation, the doctrine of caveat emptor does not apply. That duty has to be enforced, and the debtor's got to disclose all of his interest. Now, what the debtor did not disclose and was not known to the trustee at the time the release was signed was that the debtor had engaged in numerous discussions pre-petition for an interest in G.W. Burton, and those discussions were completed according to the testimony of Baron Geiser prior to the filing of the bankruptcy case. Other things occurred in this case as well, Your Honor. The problem with disclosure in the first instance was that at the time Mr. Weinschneider filed his bankruptcy case, the homes in question were in financial disrepair. Mr. Weinschneider had consented to the entry of an order whereby he agreed not to own or manage one of the properties in question. The Illinois Department of Public Aid, the City of Evanston, were concerned about anyone associated with then current or past ownership or management being involved in the management or ownership of the property and being involved in the management agreement. When Mr. Weinschneider appeared and met with officials of Home Savings on September 25, pre-petition, he recommended a group which he referred to as G.W. Burton. He was the W, and he didn't tell anybody that the W stood for Weinschneider. When he filed his bankruptcy schedules, he didn't list it in his bankruptcy schedules. And the problem is, with Weinschneider being in the position that he was in, he could not have disclosed the full nature of his interest.
Is it your view that the bankruptcy court made complete findings on the issue of this alleged fraud by Mr. Weinschneider?
We believe that the bankruptcy court made full and complete findings as to Mr. Weinschneider's failure to disclose his interest. And the ongoing failure to disclose that interest up until the end of the case. Trustee didn't know the true nature of the case until October of 1997. At that time, at the prompting of the state court judge, Weinschneider's state court attorneys provided a copy of the verified second amended complaint to the trustee. The trustee compared that complaint to what had been told to him previously in the schedules by the debtors, by the debtors' attorneys, and noted that there was a big difference. Weinschneider State Court attorneys asked the trustee to disclaim any interest that he had or may have in the state court lawsuit. The trustee, based on what was presented to him a year after he filed or signed the release, refused to sign that document. It's also the trustee's position that it was unenforceable anyway, because the only way that the interest could have been relinquished was by abandonment or sale or closing the case. The district court erred in its application of the Siegel rule when it held that Weinschneider's oral agreement with Bear and Geyser had to be in alienable or leviable form when Weinschneider filed his bankruptcy case.
Are there cases in which the Siegel doctrine was applied to a contract that was formed entirely post-petition?
The Siegel breaks down is in terms of what are the pre-petition roots of the interest. I'm not aware of cases where the contract is entered into, but in this case, even if it were entered into post-petition, the lawsuit then would have been property of the estate under 547A7, because the debtor was in Chapter 11. He was operating or attempting to reorganize his interest in the nursing homes. This was related to that attempt to reorganize, and it would have been property of the estate under 541A7. Again, given that Mr. Weinschneider was a fiduciary, he was prohibited from self-dealing. You can't use the bankruptcy case as a screen. You can't do everything up to the point of signing the contract, then file the bankruptcy, finish his deal, keep it to himself, and exclude creditors from any recovery. The cases don't countenance that, Your Honor. On the issue of alienability and leviability, that was a requirement that Siegel discussed under the old Bankruptcy Act.
How long was the contract signed? How long after he entered into bankruptcy was the contract signed?
This was an oral agreement, Your Honor. He entered into bankruptcy on October 10. The written acknowledgement of that oral agreement was signed on December 8, a week after G.W. Burton was awarded the management contract.
And they'd been in discussion for how long?
Weinschneider first approached Bear about the opportunity in the summer of 1989. They had been in more extensive discussions, which Weinschneider refers to in his verified second amended complaint, since August of 1989. September and October of 1989, leading up to the October 12 meeting in Kansas City, where Weinschneider introduced Baron Geyser. So the question really isn't did the contract have to be entered into pre-petition or post-petition. The question is the agreement on which the state court action is based, is that sufficiently rooted in the debtor's pre-petition activities? And based on this record and by the debtor's own admissions, it was either completed pre-petition or shortly after the petition was filed. And on this issue, the pre-petition roots, which we believe is, by the way, a factual determination for the bankruptcy court, the trier of fact, to make. The bankruptcy court stated that all the matters surrounding the creation of G.W. Burton and the allocations of the rights therein and the selection of the management team and the negotiation of the management agreement were either completely done before the case was filed or shortly thereafter. And based on that, bankruptcy court found that there were sufficient pre-petition roots for this lawsuit and that it was property of the estate.
Well, the bankruptcy court also conducted a trial on the fraud question, did it not?
It certainly did, Your Honor. We believe that the bankruptcy or the district court on appeal was over narrow in its focus, and that its analysis was based on the erroneous legal finding that this interest had to be alienable or leviable. And this court, again, has recognized that that's not a requirement under the bankruptcy code. There's a pattern of non-disclosure and misstatement that permeates this case. As I mentioned at the outset, it began even before Weinschneider filed his bankruptcy case. And the reason it began was that Weinschneider could not be part of the management team. If he had disclosed that, G.W. Burton never would have gotten a deal. So he kept it quiet when he introduced G.W. Burton. He didn't mention it in his schedules. And one of the most egregious examples is in January of 1990, when by Weinschneider's own characterization, he had to have been an owner of G.W. Burton because his December 8, 89 memorialization refers to the prior agreement. At that hearing, he was asked by his own lawyer who were some of the people, who comprised G.W. Burton. He named everybody but himself. He left the bankruptcy court wondering why nobody from G.W. Burton was there testifying when, in fact, Mr. Weinschneider was there. Now, this is all part of the record. And the fact that Mr. Weinschneider met with Home Savings for 9 hours prior to the bankruptcy court filing and did not mention to Home Savings that he was the W in G.W. Burton were all facts that were before the court on the issue of whether the trustee was fraudulently induced.
Does everyone agree that the W is Weinschneider?
There's no dispute as to that, Your Honor.
Okay.
W stands for Weinschneider, G stands for Geiser, and Burton is Burton W. Bear, who was the Evanston nursing home operator. I'm getting into my rebuttal time, Your Honor. I would note that, however, in the bankruptcy schedules that were filed, counsel who prepared those were not the debtor's lawyers. They were the same lawyers who were pursuing the state court action. They knew of the existence of those pre-petition activities. They made the unilateral decision not to disclose those facts to the trustee. They also had an idea of what the valuation was on that claim. They knew it was worth over $1 million. They made the unilateral decision not to disclose that to the trustee. Everything they did pointed to activities that occurred post-petition and directed the trustee's attention away from what occurred prior to the filing of the bankruptcy case. I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Radke. We'll hear now from Mr. Neufer.
May it please the Court, I'd like to first address my remarks to the property of the estate issue. As you know, the district court ruled in Weinschneider's favor on that point, and I believe there are three key reasons why this court should affirm the district court. Number one, the statutory definition of property of the estate requires an existing interest in property. Based on the record here, it's clear and undisputed that Weinschneider had no existing interest in property when he filed for bankruptcy. Number two, the trustee can take no interest greater than the debtor had on the bankruptcy filing date. And number three, under Section 541A6, the personal services exemption, Weinschneider may keep his earnings from post-petition services. The beginning point should be the language of the statute itself. Section 541 says that the estate includes, quote, all legal or equitable interests of the debtor in property as of the commencement of the case. So for something to fall into the bankruptcy estate, it has to be an interest in property. And the undisputed facts here is that before the bankruptcy filing on October 10th, all that happened were some preliminary negotiations and discussions. Okay? And
Wouldn't we open up some sort of a Pandora's box where individuals could have quote-unquote discussions, and then a week after, as occurred here, the discussions become a reality?
I think, Your Honor...
You understand what I'm saying.
I think what you're saying is that this would leave open a door whereby people could try to, not enter in an agreement until after the bankruptcy filing date. Intentionally is a way to, defraud creditors or whatever. I would suggest that is a factual issue that my opponents were never able to persuade anybody of in this case, and the record is very voluminous. Sidney Weinschneider was negotiating and trying to work things out, but his filing of the bankruptcy was independent of these other things, and G.W. Burton was actually incorporated by my opponent's lawyers about a week after the bankruptcy filing. And he said that there was some questions about whether Weinschneider, the W stands for Weinschneider. Yes, it does. But before bankruptcy, G.W. Burton had never been formed. And so I respectfully disagree with my opponent's claim that Weinschneider purposely concealed the fact that he was the W in G.W. Burton, because G.W. Burton had not been formed. And all that happened were preliminary discussions before that. Your Honor, if I might just say, go one point further, the bankruptcy code establishes a pretty clear line. If there's an existing interest in property, it falls into the estate. But if there's not, then it doesn't fall into the estate.
Unless, of course, there was fraud involved.
Right. But I don't believe that there was any finding on this issue that there was fraud involved by the bankruptcy court.
Should this case be remanded to the bankruptcy court for more definitive findings?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. There has been extensive discovery, and remember that the property of the estate issue came up on cross motions for summary judgment, so the facts are really not in dispute. What happened pre-petition is already in the record. There was multiple days of videotaped testimony, and my opponent keeps going back to the general allegations of the second amended complaint. Well, each of the three parties testified under oath at length that there was no pre-petition contract. That's undisputed. So I don't think there's any need to remand for further fact-finding here.
Of course, the district court's analysis would make sense only if we were to decide that the bankruptcy court engaged in illogical reasoning and conducted an unnecessary trial on the fraud question. Right?
I'm not sure I follow your question, Your Honor. The trial was on the enforceability of the release and the covenant not to sue. Now, on that point, the district court held that, number one, the trustee failed to meet his burden on two counts. First of all, he failed to prove that there was a misstatement of material fact, and he also failed to prove that Weinschneider lied and knowingly lied. Okay? Without proving those elements, it was the trustee's burden by clear and convincing evidence to somehow show that the release was invalid. And there was a 6-day trial, and the only thing that my opponents could convince the bankruptcy court that was a misstatement was statements in the amended B3 when Sidney Weinschneider actually disclosed his interest.
But that's enough, isn't it? That would be enough.
That would be enough, but the problem with the bankruptcy court's analysis is that what we said in the amendment was factually correct. The disagreement was about the legal conclusion. And as the district court correctly said, a statement of a conclusion of law cannot form the basis for a fraudulent misrepresentation claim. That is the issue. All they could say is that our legal conclusion was wrong. The facts that we set forth, or that Weinschneider set forth in the amendment, were correct. And again, it was their burden to establish that there was some kind of fraud or misstatement, and the only thing that they could convince the district court of was the statements in the amended B3.
Under circumstances like we have here, how could you ever do that, save someone sort of confessing?
Well, I think you could come up with, just as my opponents tried to do, circumstantial evidence, testimony of conversations between people, maybe and admissions that the other person made to a third party. But that was their burden, and they had to show it by clear and convincing evidence, and they simply didn't do it, especially on the point where they said that they're trying to meet the element that Weinschneider knowingly made a false statement. Weinschneider was following the counsel of his attorneys, and the only thing that they could come up with was conclusions of law that they said was false. And of course, the district court clearly found that the conclusions of law in there were correct. The second reason on the property of the estate issue to affirm is that the trustee can take no greater interest than the debtor had on the filing date. That principle is a bedrock principle. It comes right out of the legislative history of Section 541, and it clearly supports the district court's ruling in this issue. I'd now like to touch briefly on the third reason that the property of the estate issue favors Weinschneider, and that is Section 541A6's personal services exemption. Under Section 541A6, property of the estate does not include earnings from services performed by an individual debtor after the commencement of the case. Now, the district court specifically found that the party's agreement was for Weinschneider to perform continued services, to bring to Burton the opportunity to get that management agreement, and as counsel said, that they didn't get the management agreement until 2 or 3 months after the bankruptcy filing, and the agreement was also to provide continued advice to Baron Geiser on nursing home management. In exchange for those continued services, he gets 23% interest of a corporation that was formed after the bankruptcy filing. He was not given 23% interest in exchange for anything he said or did pre-petition. The services, the first introduction happened post-petition. And then all the services after that, negotiating with the bank, trying to get that management contract, they all happened post-petition.
See, let me just, forgive me, but here's my problem. I don't see why we can't just assume that Mr. Weinschneider entered the Burton agreement in his capacity as a debtor in possession, because Burton's management contract both flows from the estate's interest in the nursing homes. Mr. Weinschneider averred that home savings approached him because of his vested interest in the homes, and it benefited the estate's primary creditor, Home Savings, to whom Weinschneider remains personally liable for the deficiency that was left after the foreclosures. So it seems to me that it follows that Mr. Weinschneider entered the Burton agreement as a debtor in possession rather than in his personal capacity.
Your Honor,
if you could help me with that.
I understand the issue and the problem there, and I think that I would resolve it along these lines, and that is, if you start down that path, then you're diluting and undermining 541A6, because the code does not make a distinction. The cases are very clear that even when you're in Chapter 11, a Chapter 11 debtor in possession is entitled to keep the compensation that he earns from personal services. Okay? It's clear. Now, this is not like...
Unless there was fraud. I mean, I just keep coming back.
And again, I would submit that they failed to prove fraud, and that was their burden if they were going to try to unwind the settlement and the release that they signed. But clearly, all the cases say that we're not going to... 541A6 entitles a debtor to a fresh start. And all he was doing was trying to provide some services here, and he's entitled to that compensation.
A fresh start, but not a head start, right?
Yes, Your Honor. a fresh start, but not a head start. I would...
It's a personal service exemption. Suppose a contract was agreed that it was entered into prior to the filing of the bankruptcy. What happens to the personal services then?
Yeah, even if they convince you that it was pre-petition, he's still entitled to compensation for post-petition services. And in this case, the only services of any value happen post-petition. And so that has to fall, it does not fall into the bankruptcy estate, it falls into his own personal property.
Yeah, since the filing of this, since the filing of all of your briefs, has anything more happened in state court?
No.
Well, that's, it's on hold.
It's on hold, yeah. The two main reasons I would suggest why the district court's opinion on the release issue should be affirmed is, one, the trustee simply failed to prove fraud, and two, a statement of a conclusion of law cannot form the basis of a fraudulent misrepresentation claim. If there are no further questions, we'd respectfully request that the district court be affirmed on all counts except that summary judgment on the property of the estate issue should be granted for Weinschneider, because we believe there is no disputed issue of fact. Before he filed for bankruptcy, as a matter of Illinois law, he had no pre-petition interest in property that could fall into the bankruptcy estate, and we think we should have gotten summary judgment from that point. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Mr. Reich, you have 2 minutes, sir.
If Weinschneider were seeking wages, salary, compensation, 541A6 might apply. What he's looking for is a share of the profits, share generated by the work of other people long after he was no longer associated with this deal. 541A6 does not apply. The bankruptcy court also did find that Mr. Weinschneider failed to disclose material facts. It wasn't just a conclusion of law.
He's not being asked to provide any advice or assistance?
No, he's in Florida. He's not involved. He hasn't been involved. He wasn't involved when the deal was closed. He moved to Florida, you know, within a short period of time after he filed his bankruptcy case and was not part of the picture. Debtor has an affirmative duty, and it's ongoing, and it's an absolute affirmative duty to fully disclose, and this debtor did not do that. What would happen if this case... if the district court's opinion were permitted to stand, would be that any unscrupulous debtor would be encouraged to do all his due diligence, complete all his negotiations, even go to the point of preparing all his paperwork, wait and file his bankruptcy case, and sign and finish the documents the next day without telling anybody. And then we would be able to reap the benefit of the bargain, and creditors would get nothing. Again, it's a breach of his fiduciary duties to do this in secret and self-deal for his own benefit, and it's an unconscionable result under the circumstances of this case. And as a general matter as to the release, Your Honor, there are no cases in a bankruptcy context that say that a release entered in non-related litigation as a matter of law bars a trustee from pursuing a declaratory judgment action. All a declaratory judgment action does is set out what the rights of the parties are. If this was property of the estate, it became property of the estate ab initio before the case, before the release was ever signed. And the only way the trustee can relinquish that is by selling it or abandoning it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Radke. The court thanks both Mr.